I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we're going to take a Friday visit to the gym to learn about what college students are calling gymorexia, compulsive exercising. But first, there was an altercation in northern Kosovo today between UN police and minority Serbs protesting Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia. The protest took place on a bridge connecting the city of Mitrovica, which is divided between Serbs and ethnic Albanians. And it comes a day after the American embassy in the Serbian capital of Belgrade was set on fire after protests turned violent. Both Serbs and Kosovars have condemned that violence, and in a moment, we'll speak with a Serb who was there. But first, we start with Neil MacDonald of the Financial Times. He's in Kosovo. In fact, Neil, you're in Mitrovica. What's happened there?
Well, things are calm now. There was a demonstration basically on the, you know, this is the fifth day since Kosovo declared independence on Sunday. So there was a demonstration here, but the numbers were fairly low. I'd say several hundred people, because another 300 or 350 university students were stopped at the border by NATO troops and Kosovo police.
This is the border with Serbia, where yesterday there was the attack at the American embassy in Belgrade. Today, the Serb president has called an emergency meeting of the Serbian National Security Council. He says the violence that erupted should never happen again. But how are things in Serbia today?
Belgrade today is calm. You know, the streets have been cleaned up, but about 90 shops were damaged, and you know, most of the windows are broken along the main shopping street. People are in something of a state of shock after what happened yesterday, although they're divided about whether to blame, you know, the sort of hooligan element among the demonstrators, or to also partly blame the countries that recognized Kosovo's independence.
Which is the U.S. Well, let's just remind ourselves, Kosovo had been under U.N. control since 1999, and at that time NATO airstrikes brought an end to the Serb crackdown on ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Those same ethnic Albanians, the majority, declared independence on Sunday. What is the thinking as to what might happen now? You know, is Serbia going to side with the West and join the European Union, or perhaps edge more towards Russia?
Serbia is in a real quandary, because most people see the only real prospect for economic success to be with closer integration with the European Union. But with, you know, leading EU members recognizing Kosovo in you know, the first half week of its existence as an independent state, most Serbs feel deeply insulted. So it's a question, in a sense, how long it takes them to put that aside and pursue integration with the European Union anyway. But of course, it's not that simple, because you also have the Serb minority here, and basically, you know, quite complicated border issues could really keep Serbia stuck and keep it moving more towards Russia.
Serbs feeling that many of their religious shrines, for instance, are still in the Kosovo area, and as you said, the Serb minority there. Neil MacDonald, reporting for the Financial Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
To understand more about Kosovo, we go now to someone who took part in yesterday's protests before they turned violent. Ivana Markovic is a 40-year-old Serb who grew up in Kosovo but fled after the UN took control of the province in 1999. She joins us now on the line. Ivana, why did you take part in the protests in Belgrade?
It's a very simple answer, because I still feel Kosovo as my homeland. I'm living in Belgrade, let's say, 7-8 years now. But Kosovo is part of me. I mean, I am Kosovo.
You could still return to a Kosovo. It would just be an independent, different, you know, it would be a country, but it's still going to be Kosovo.
It's completely different story, different kind of people living there, different policy, different structure of the town. It's not my country. I mean, my country is Serbia, and Kosovo is a part of Serbia.
Do you worry as a Serb that you might not be safe in a Kosovo that would now be led by the ethnic Albanian majority?
Absolutely. I mean, things are happening down there still, but no one is emphasizing that side of the story.
What was your feeling when the protest, the government-backed rally yesterday, turned into a protest and then into the riot that led to the fire? What, as you watched, what were you thinking?
In the beginning, at the protest, I was so proud to be the part of that crowd in front of the church, for example, when people were standing with candles and praying. And then later on, I mean, after hour and a half, I mean, completely different mixed feelings when I realized what's going on. I mean, on the other part of the town, all this violence and crazy thinking. It's not correct to demolish your own town. I was completely shocked and I was embarrassed. American embassy was demolished, Turkish embassy, Bosnian Herzegovina embassy, British embassy, but also bakery, private vehicles, markets. Last night you couldn't go on the square where the McDonald's is. They were grabbing as much as they can. I mean, pharmacy was broken also.
Given the damage that happened to Serbia, to Belgrade, in protest over Kosovo's independence, do you think that Serbia needs to let go of Kosovo? So,
absolutely not. Absolutely not. Definitely not.
Even if it means that Serbia will begin destroying itself?
Yes. Yes. Because last night, an SMS, I received the SMS, which was circulating around, all Jewish sentence, see you next year in Jerusalem. And they did it 1,000 years after that. And that will, the same thing will happen with Kosovo. And now the main sentence is, see you next year in Pristina. Even it will happen 1,000 years from now, but it will be one day.
You got this message on your cell phone,
yeah,
a text message. Next year in Pristina.
Yes.
Ivana Marković, a 40-year-old Serbian woman who grew up in Kosovo, is now living in Serbia. She opposes Kosovo's declaration of independence. Ivana, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
As you enter Boston University's new state-of-the-art fitness center, right across the street from our home station, WBUR, here in Boston, you can already hear, past the giant rock-climbing wall, past the Olympic-sized pool, the hum of dozens of treadmills, elliptical machines, the clank of free weights in the main exercise area. The room is a blur of pumping arms and legs, but what you can't see, unless you're watching closely, is the obsession, what our college interns say kids are calling gymorexia. A recent National Eating Disorders Association study found that nearly half of college students polled said they knew someone who compulsively exercised. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a professor who says she sees it all the time. But first, we want you to meet Jamie Lynn.
I'm a first-year grad student.
While researching this story, one of our producers was wandering the BU complex and approached Jamie to ask if she knew any over-exercisers, and she said...
Yeah, that was completely me in undergrad. I was a gym rat, and, like, everybody in the gym knew me. Every bodybuilder and I were, like, good friends, and it's just, like, I was just fitness girl. Like, I lived there.
Well, I have to say, you are very physically fit. You look like a terrific athlete. But what was your perception of yourself that drove you to work out so much?
Well, I was always an athlete in high school, but I was always a little bit overweight. And I moved to Miami. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but, you know, it's the land of beautiful people. It was sunny all the time. You're always in shorts. You're always in tank tops. And I had this gym, like, a half a second away from me at my disposal for free. I didn't have sports anymore. You have, like, freedom to be whoever you want to be when you move away like that. And I think that's what a lot of girls are with college. It's like you're going away. No one knows your name. You're like create yourself. And I thought, like, why not lose all this weight? I did, and it became very powerful. It's an extremely addicting feeling to be attractive and to, like, get attention. And, you know, just being there, and there's, like, all these guys and girls and new people, new faces, and it's like, okay, you're attractive. That's, like, exciting. It's like a drug, and anyone can attest to that.
Was some of it, too, that you were working out to get that way? So you felt good. I mean, working out can make you feel good.
Exactly. And it was, like, this weird dichotomy because it started to become an obsession, and it started getting dangerous. But at the same time, like, I couldn't see it any other way, and it did make you feel good. So I was, like, happy because I had endorphins in my head all the time, but, like, really deep inside, like, people that do that are really sad.
Well, and tell me more about that. I mean, how did it start to turn on you, if you will?
I just realized that my eating started getting affected, and then I start, like, when you start feeling guilty about not going, and you feel like, okay, I ate this, now I have to go work it off, that's like a form of purging, it's a form of bulimia. And I started becoming kind of an expert in this. I would read, like, Shape and Fitness, and even women's bodybuilding magazines. Like, I just take things to extreme, I'm kind of a black and white person. It's when the eating gets bad, and then everything else starts, you know, it's a cycle.
Spirals out from there.
Yeah, and I had... The only reason I, like, had to break that cycle is because I had to get help for it. I developed an eating disorder because of everything. And I guess it had been going on since high school, but the over-exercising was never really a part of it. So it just, they went hand in hand. You start restricting, and then you want to binge, and then you restrict, and it's just this evil cycle.
Did someone tell you you needed help, or did you know?
I definitely knew. And when I finally just admitted it to my mom, she was like, oh, that explains like why you're so weird and why you're like so obsessed about this. And together we got help, and I started seeing a psychologist, and there's only so much they can do for you before they have to refer you to a specialist, and I did. And they restricted my exercising. Like, they couldn't force me and hold me in bars, but they said, like, you really need to restrict this. And it was kind of like a relief to me in a way. I didn't really fight it because it was kind of just like, thank you for telling me that that's okay.
At this point, there was a long pause. Jamie had tears in her eyes. We were close. This is just so sad.
It took me like a long time to like realize that I have to have a balance. Balancing is so much harder than it sounds. It sounds so easy. It makes so much sense to find the gray in things. And even like Christmas break, I didn't work out one day for a month, and the guilt starts coming back, and it starts making me that girl again. And I don't want that. You know, I'm older. I have this beautiful facility, and I need to make it a positive thing for me. I really have to. Even just now, like, I had to get that 30 minutes in. It's my goal right now. Like, I'm on, like, a little bit of a kick, but it's, like, really, I think, a healthy thing. I'm doing only 30 minutes, like, four times a week, and that's even a lot for me, so.
As opposed to, I mean, your restrictions, before your restrictions, how many hours would you say you were in the gym?
About 1.5 to 2 hours a day. But the thing is, I was also very healthy about working out. I would only do, like, 40 minutes of cardio. Like, it was very textbook. Like, what I saw in the magazines is, like, they would eat a protein bar and an apple, and that was okay for their 5 meals a day thing. And so by the books, it maybe would have made sense. I looked great. I didn't look sick or anything like that. So part of me still wants to be that way. Like, there's a part in my mind that's like, God, I wish I could just do that again.
So you are constantly, and especially, I wonder, too, you want to come in the gym, have a little bit of a workout, and so it's like an alcoholic going to a bar, maybe, you know, for you to look around.
It is, and I see some of the girls, and like it gets me emotional sometimes, and I see like the classic look, the thin arms and like the slouch shoulders, and you can tell like this is their thing. This is what they're doing all the time.
Do you feel sorry for them? Or
yeah, I just like wish I could use my 25-year-old wisdom and like be able to talk to them and like grab them. And, you know, I've seen it in a couple of people I work with, and I just want to be able to help them because I went through so much, you know. So it's a little bit sad, and what do you do?
Well, you've just done a lot. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
No problem.
Jamie Lynn, a grad student at Boston University. So what's going on here? Is she alone? A sociology professor says no, and she's studied religious cults to try to understand the students she meets with body image obsession. She's next. And later, we just want to tell you we have an update on our Guantanamo Bay coverage. The former U.S. military prosecutor who quit over what he called political interference now says he'll testify on behalf of a detainee. We'll have that update later. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're back with more of our look at what college students are calling gymorexia, compulsively exercising to a point where it actually becomes unhealthy. Boston University's fitness director, Rosella Avotabile-Muller, says there's no serious problem with overexercise at BU, but they still have a system of soft intervention. For instance, if they feel a student is in the gym too much, they begin to track that student's ID swipes as they enter.
The students on staff at the weight room are trained in looking for a student who spends a lot of time on the equipment. If we come to the realization that there is a problem of overexercising, then we will send them over to student health services, and they have to get cleared to come back to work out.
Rosella says they've only had to do that a few times at Boston University, but now we want to bring into the conversation Boston College sociology professor Charlene Hess-Biber. She says this is a nationwide problem on the rise. She is author of Am I Thin Enough Yet? The Cult of Thinness and the Commercialization of Identity. We sat down on a weight bench at BU's state-of-the-art facility to ask her, what is the problem?
The problem is when you're working out 7 days a week, and you're working out in an obsessional way, and you're working out when you're sick. As one of my students said the other day, she crawled to the treadmill. She was so ill, but she couldn't not work out.
Does working out cross over into addiction?
There is, in fact, a term, exercise addiction. And one definition of it was, if you feel you're working out over 3 hours, 7 days a week, and you're doing it because you feel you need to, when you don't take your friends seriously and you don't go out with them because you want to exercise, you're kind of isolating yourself out from family and friends.
In fact, you interviewed people who were in religious cults and got some more understanding of people who were addicted to exercise.
Yes. Comparing exercising and, you know, eating issues to a cult is sort of like looking at rituals. I mean, you can think of coming to the gym for many of these individuals with exercise addiction as their rituals. In some ways, you know, weight obsession becomes like a religion. One of my students said to me, you know, Charlene, every morning when I wake up, I go to my bureau. And she said, on that bureau, I have pictures of all my favorite models. And I look at that, and I almost like kneel before the bureau, and I want to get pumped up. They give me inspiration.
You also write about a couple of other things you've observed in the culture. First of all the messages we get are thin. Even our computers are thin.
Yes. Actually, one of the interesting things, if you think about people's notion of self, you know, where does your self begin and end? Where are the boundaries? Our boundaries become very fluid. And this idea that, you know, we use our consumer items as extensions of ourselves.
And we are seen in this culture, whatever our weights are, more than we've ever been seen before. That's so interesting. I mean, young people especially are so much more conscious of being visible.
Well, we're a very visual culture. I mean, if you think about Facebook, you think about even the term Facebook, you think about, especially in a gym, a lot of the time, I don't see too many mirrors in this gym, but, you know, mirrors are everywhere. What constant, oh, there's one in back of us. Oh, my goodness. Oh, look at my body. No, I'm just teasing. I'm just kidding. We're constantly observing each other. There's sort of this notion, as one woman said to me, we police each other's bodies. Women's bodies are on public display, and people feel they can make comments about it.
How much do these super gyms, we're again sitting at Boston University's, it is colossal and beautiful. Running tracks around the roof, three different swimming pools. There's one pool that's just an exercise pool. The current runs against you, and so you can strengthen your legs by walking in it. I mean, it's just state-of-the-art and huge and beautiful. But how much has the construction of these gyms altered the terrain for young women in college? What are you seeing?
I think what it does is it raises expectations. I mean, we used to be able to say, well, I've lost weight, I've been on a diet. But when Jane Fonda came along, she blew all of those ideas apart by saying, not only you have to be thin, you have to be firm. As one of my students said, I have to have those cuts, you know. And to get those cuts, I've got to come to the gym.
They're talking about being cut as in having muscles. And
muscles, right. And to do that, you also have to really, really starve yourself. Now, I'm not saying that exercise isn't healthy, isn't good for you. I mean, we're an obese culture. Obviously, exercise in moderation is good. But when you're pushing the envelope, when you're getting osteoporosis, when you're starving yourself, I mean, one of my fears especially is among varsity athletes. A lot of these athletes are under the radar because the coaches are going to say, well, you're working out, that's good. But is the coach really going to say to a woman, did you lose your period? Those discussions are a little uncomfortable for a male coach to have with a female athlete. But the reality is, we know that female athletes, and by the way, male athletes, are at high risk for developing eating issues and over-exercise problems.
What are your concerns with men?
For men, being virile, being muscular, is important in this culture. And I think steroid use among men, and young boys even, is increasing.
I guess I'm saying, you know, I look around, we all know that a lot of the issues of weight are in the mind, people's
right.
Perceptions of themselves. But are there people who are living in the gym, over-exercising, and in fact they don't have a weight problem at all, and never did? It's about socially isolating themselves.
Well, I think one way to gain control of your life is through rituals. When you feel everything else is out of control, you come to the gym. And you're feeling good. You've accomplished something.
Do you think schools, in their competition to build these huge gyms and lure kids, are fueling the problem?
It's creating levels of expectations that people feel they have to go to the gym or they're not part of the social scene. Because going to the gym is a huge part of meeting other people. And it becomes like another college ritual. For those who are already on the edge of obsession with exercise, it might make it more normalized to do it. You know, there's this normalization. When you're in a cult, you know, it's very hard to see something as abnormal because it becomes so normal. I mean, plastic surgery has become so normalized. To get the body that's required of you today, you've got to buy, try, comply, and spend tremendous amount of your time on body work. Is this what we want our college students doing with their $50,000 a year? I mean, we need to think. Gyms are not negative places, but the obsessional nature of what it is that goes on at many of these gyms is a problem. And when we push the line between normality and abnormality into the more normal range, I think we need to think about what we're doing.
Charlene Hess-Biber, Boston College sociology professor and author of Am I Thin Enough Yet? The Cult of Thinness and the Commercialization of Identity. Still ahead, an Oscar-nominated Israeli film, Here and Now. After decades of hostility following an outright war, China and India are renewing their ancient business and cultural ties. And according to our next guest, Tarun Khanna, it may be the most important story of our time. Like it or not, he writes, the world's future is tied to China and India. China-India trade is growing by 50% a year. Their armies are conducting joint military exercises, and their businesses are recruiting workers in each other's countries. In many ways, the two countries couldn't be more different. But Khanna writes, that yin-yang is precisely why they will fit together so well in the future, and Westerners who are caught napping will be left in their dust. Tarun Khanna is a professor at Harvard Business School. His new book is called Billions of Entrepreneurs, How China and India Are Reshaping Their Future and Yours, and he joins us now. Professor, define what you call the China-India yin-yang, the differences that can help bring these two countries together.
Right, so there are two fundamental ways in which the two societies are different, right? One has to do with the way in which information becomes accessible or not accessible in the two societies. The other has to do with property rights. Let's take an example. If I have to build a road from my end of this table that we're sitting on to where you're sitting, mm-hmm. and somebody's property happens to be in the way, and we happen to be sitting in China, the property owner's out of luck. In India, individual rights are paramount, so it may be in the interest of society to have this road, but the individual will hold things up ad nauseum, take it all the way to the Supreme Court, and tie the process up in knots. So a simple road is very hard to build, an airport is hard to build. In China, you can mandate conversion of marshlands and forestry into cities pretty much overnight. Now, if you think about what the Indian system has done is it's created a system where you see a lot of private entrepreneurship happening, where you see intangible assets being created, where you see industries being created of the sort that don't require roads and physical infrastructure. But if physical infrastructure becomes important, then all bets are off and you better be in China. So the upshot is that China is able to make things like toys and machines and electronic equipment and things of that nature that require big spanking factories and clean roads and port facilities. So you have India creating some of these information-based businesses and industries that don't rely on hard infrastructure, China creating the hard infrastructure, and that creates the possibility for marriage.
Of a synergy
between them.
Yeah, but you also seem to be saying that Western companies would be smart to be in both India and China and not pick one over the other. Give us an example of a Western company that has figured this out in your mind.
It's very hard to figure it out. And part of the reason for that is that it takes very different skills to succeed in China than it takes to succeed in India. That said, a company that I often look to as an exemplar of success in both countries is General Electric. If you look at GE Healthcare's machines, the software for them is often created in Bangalore and other parts of South India. The hardware is created, amongst other places, in different parts of China. But it's taken them a long time to figure out how to do that.
Give us some stats. Give us some of the numbers, because you talk about what is happening now and what's possible in the future.
Today, the percentage of world trade accounted by China and India is 10 or 12% or 14%, depending on how you count it. But the projection is that those numbers will rise much more. Just under half of world trade will involve either China or India. In other words, it's very hard to get away from them. Mm-hmm. Another number would be just the extent to which China and India are actually beginning to interact with each other. The number of companies that have begun to open offices in each other, trade with each other, hire each other's citizens. Commensurate with that, China-India trade has gone from non-existent to a couple of $1 million to a couple of $1 billion to $20 billion to $40 billion. And every time either of the foreign ministers of China or India makes a projection in a time frame, it's rapidly eclipsed faster than it was projected.
How much are these numbers and projections validating for you? I refer back to the Princeton student that you write about decades ago who came and your roommates didn't even know where the country was. That was you.
I don't think of this as validation or redemption. I think of this as something that I think we all ought to be tremendously excited about. I think it's very cool that a lot of people are being lifted out of poverty for the first time. There are literally 300, 400, 500 million people that now can eat. And somehow I have to feel that the sheer humanity of it has got to be a good thing for all of us. And that's why I'm so happy about it and so bullish about it. And that's why I want to tell this story.
How important to this story are Indians and Chinese who've left the countries and are maybe sending money back from the outside? How much are they factoring into this story?
I think this is a huge part of the story. One of the big differences between China and India that I describe in the book is that China had something called the Cultural Revolution, and India did not. And the Cultural Revolution amounted to wiping the slate clean in a pretty terrible way in China. And what that meant was that when Deng Xiaoping reopened the economy in 1978, he and his administration turned to overseas Chinese, people who were settled outside, for help and assistance and foreign capital to come in. India also has an overseas population, but one of the most catastrophic stories of mismanagement in modern economic times is India's shunning of its diaspora, with the attitude traditionally being, you left us, therefore you don't have a place here. Now, India has taken a page from China's book and has reached out to its diaspora, and that has been reversed. The old attitude has been reversed to no inconsiderable extent.
Well, you just mentioned that China in that way maybe shifted attitudes in India. How do you see this growing relationship changing China?
That's a great question. My view is that most of the central tendencies of what we see in China and India are not going to change in my professional lifetime. So one sees incremental moves to learn from each other and try to adopt good features of the other society, which is terrific. But the central tendency of the two parts, the yin and the yang, are pretty much set for the near term.
Give us some examples of the people that you met, just some of the characters that you've met and you know what they're saying to you that makes this such an impassioned plea for you.
One of my favorite stories is an entirely serendipitous encounter around midnight when a Chinese student and I were walking around very close to Tiananmen Square in the Forbidden City in the back alleys, what's called the Hutongs in China. And you see your typical scene of people sipping tea and boiled tea eggs and noodle shops and cycle rickshaws and all the migrant workers are not supposed to be there, but everybody sort of recognizes they're there anyway. And I took a cycle rickshaw, and I asked a question that I frequently ask people in China. I said, when I just say the word India, what do you conjure up in your mind? And it didn't take him a millisecond to respond. He burst into song, and he sang this song from my childhood, from the 60s, from a movie called Awara, which means vagabond in Hindi. It was a very famous song. He just burst into it, and all the words were in Hindi, and he sang it flawlessly. He sang the tune flawlessly, and he had no idea what it meant.
Do you worry that this growing relationship could, you know, as it gets more intense, then also potentially be more volatile if there's a problem? I mean, these two countries are still competing for oil, outbidding each other to buy up oil around the world.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I think there are plenty of flashpoints that could derail Sino-Indian cooperation in the years to come. On the issue of oil, it's interesting because even the state-owned enterprises are now cooperating with each other. And whatever one makes of the decision to do it and whatever value judgments you want to put on it, it is a rapprochement that one would have considered infeasible, say, even 5 or 10 years ago.
Tharun Khanna is the Jorge Paulo Lehmann Professor at Harvard Business School. His new book is called Billions of Entrepreneurs, How China and India Are Reshaping Their Future and Yours. Professor Khanna, thanks so much for coming to speak to us about it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's take some time for some of your thoughts. And many of them have been on campaign coverage. For instance, in our profile of Senator John McCain, I said it was surprising to meet so many voters torn between Democrat Barack Obama and Republican John McCain, given McCain's stand against abortion. Well, Matthew, a registered Democrat from Phoenix, Arizona, wrote to say, How can I vote for a Republican? Because I vote with my eyes, ears, and mind. With McCain, I see a proven maverick who's shown he can work both sides of the aisle. But by the way, if Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, then I'm voting for Hillary. With Hillary, I see a seasoned politician who can and will succeed with anybody's Congress. We aired our Barack Obama profile this week. Pam Wolf of Hull, Massachusetts, thought it was way too negative. She writes, "Let us hear what the candidates are saying directly, not filtered and colored by you." But Sylvia Blanchett of Cincinnati wrote, "Thank you for your clear-eyed coverage of the candidates. I, for one, did not know John McCain was pledged to appoint judges who would overturn Roe v. Wade, and that information pushed me solidly into the Obama camp. Now that I'm here, I'm glad your guest, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, raised the questions she did, because the Republicans certainly will. We have to hold our candidates' feet to the fire so that they're ready when the real campaign starts." Well, Carol Mitchell of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, called to say she's just enjoying the whole process.
Over the last couple of elections, there was always a kind of a feeling, especially when talking to my son and daughter, about, well, we're going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Now we have Hillary Clinton, we have Barack Obama, we have John McCain. They are excited about this political process. I mean, what a phenomenal time to be living in.
Politics made its way into other stories as well. We spoke recently with retired Army Colonel and Boston University Professor Andrew Bacevich, who said the military surge in Iraq had achieved a stalemate, that violence would surge again when surge troops leave this summer. Scott Wallen of Phoenix, Arizona, wrote, "The Republican White House strategy is to declare victory based on the temporary reduction in violence, and then when it flares up after the surge, blame the Democrats and claim we had this thing all but won. That's also why the Bush administration has waited until now to charge the Guantanamo detainees for September 11th, to make sure that the next president, if it's a Democrat, has to either stop the trials or let them go forward based on torture-derived evidence. I'm 49. I've been a Republican since I was 18. But the partisanship of this crop of Republicans has almost convinced me to switch parties." Well, speaking of Guantanamo detainees, we have an update on a report we brought you yesterday. We spoke with Air Force Brigadier General Thomas Hartman, legal advisor to the Pentagon's military commissions charged with trying Guantanamo detainees. We asked him about the former chief military prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay, Air Force Colonel Morris Davis, who resigned in October in protest over what he called political interference from the Pentagon lawyer, William Haynes. Here's a part of our exchange yesterday, starting with my question about Colonel Davis's claim. Davis says that Haynes told him, "We can't have acquittals if we've been holding these guys for so long. How can we explain letting them off? We can't have acquittals. We've got to have convictions." Those words sound like he was faced with a system that had been stacked.
Well, I can assure you the system is not stacked. Colonel Davis left his function in October. He was a participant in the process for 2 years, brought three cases to trial. In the last 4 months, we have sworn or referred 10 cases. So we wish Colonel Davis well, but our focus is elsewhere.
Well, today, Colonel Davis, the former Guantanamo prosecutor, says he's going to testify on behalf of one of the Guantanamo detainees he was once charged with prosecuting, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, the driver for Osama bin Laden. The Associated Press quotes Davis as calling it an opportunity to tell the truth. Now, the Pentagon may not allow Colonel Davis to testify. Meanwhile, defense attorneys say they may try to remove General Hartman, who you just heard, from that case. We'll continue to follow all of this for you. We always appreciate your thoughts on anything on the program. Send them to letters@here-now.org or call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. After a break, an Oscar-nominated film about an Israeli mission that maybe shouldn't have happened. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's spring 2000. The militant Lebanese group Hezbollah is raining rockets down on Israeli soldiers garrisoned on the side of a mountain in southern Lebanon, beneath the ruins of a fortress built by the Crusaders in the 12th century. It's known as Beaufort. The soldiers live an isolated, claustrophobic existence. Their mountain outpost feels more like a submarine, with thin corridors and crammed sleeping quarters. They wait for the next rockets to fall. These are the latest in a long line of Israeli troops who've guarded the outpost since Israel captured it on the first day of the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. They learn it may have been a mistake to capture the mountain, and they're about to give it up. Ron Leshem wrote about the Israeli soldiers who defended and then evacuated the fortress in his novel Beaufort. He also co-wrote the screenplay for the film of the same name, which is up for an Oscar on Sunday as Best Foreign Language Entry. And he joins us from New York with more. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, let's remind our listeners it's based on a true story. Beaufort was a fortress built by the Crusaders in the 12th century. Since then, it had become a strategic military importance. It said that whoever rules Beaufort rules southern Lebanon. In the film, yeah. the Israelis have built this sort of, you know, fortified bunker, 18 years of cement piling up just beneath this breathtaking Crusader fortress on this side of this mountain. But it was a mountain they actually weren't supposed to even take 18 years earlier. Tell that story.
There was an order not to conquer the mountain, but they were so passionate about it because the soldiers that took it in 1982, they were so passionate about it because they were practicing towards it. So somehow, deliberately or not, the order not to take the mountain disappeared. And it was a very bloody battle, but somehow it turned out to be a symbol, on the one hand, a symbol for hero's battle, but also a symbol for simplicity of death and unnecessary death. And all the Israeli protests against war and the family of the victims, all the protests started there from this point of view. So this is a very important point in the Israeli history.
Well, Israel stayed on the mountain they weren't supposed to take for 18 years. As the film opens, they will be leaving. Describe the troops' reaction to that.
This last year of existence on the mountain was a year where their only mission was try not to die. They were just trying not to die because the Israeli public couldn't handle any more death. So they didn't have any action and activities. They were just sitting on the mountains, suffering as missiles that were falling on them. And the fear is an addictive thing, and the fear is
it's catching. The fear is catching. Yeah,
the fear is catching.
Well, and it's also increasing because Hezbollah knows that there's going to be an evacuation. So they raise the intensity of the rocket strikes, thinking that they can create the headline that Israel ran away in defeat.
Yeah.
And these troops have to know that as well.
At the beginning, when they understood, suddenly, one after another, the soldiers start understanding that there is no necessity to be there on the mountain, and the wall of denial starts collapsing, and this is the point that where the fear starts attacking them. What I try to do is to bring only the voices of the very young soldiers without no generals, with no enemy. You can't see the enemy even once, and you don't feel skirmishes and battlefields. You can just feel the voices of the very young kids.
Even though they're not taking any action against Hezbollah, they are waiting for evacuation. They're still dying, you know, dying trying to defuse roadside bombs, dying when they are in a lookout post that gets attacked. Did you talk to the actual soldiers who manned Beaufort?
The lead character of the book is inspired by a young soldier that I met randomly while I was reporting from the field as a journalist. And a beautiful 21-year-old, dark-skinned, charismatic, interesting guy. And I was so moved and shocked by his story and by the fact that I was so oblivious to what went on that a month later I waited outside his base on the day he was released from the army and managed to convince him to spend a week holding a hotel telling me his amazing tales. And eventually that's what became the story of Beaufort.
Liraz Liberty is the commander of the group. By the way, is he the character that you're speaking of that's at the sentence? He's not your typical heroic commander. He freezes at one point when one of his men is screaming for help and he can't do it, and he has a tug of war over a bomb-sniffing dog that he wants to stay with his unit and it's supposed to be evacuated. He seems a little immature in some ways, but he's also the one, as you said, who's, you know, something about him. He doesn't want to leave the mountain. Did he ever explain to you what that is?
I think he didn't have to explain. The moment he left there was maybe the saddest moment of his life, because the place that he felt most important in, the first place he felt relevant, suddenly blown away, and he had to start his life over again. And it doesn't matter whether he'll be a lawyer or a taxi driver, the most interesting and fascinating and exciting days of his life were there on the mountain.
They do leave. They are evacuated. They blow up their outpost behind them. We understand that this film was being put together when the second incursion of Lebanon occurred in 2006, when Israel invaded after the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. Do people mention Beaufort when they talk about modern-day conflicts?
Yeah, Beaufort is a symbol, and it is a very important part of the Israeli modern history.
When the film opened, there was a lot of debate. Did you see the film as a story about the futility of war, the futility of this one action in this one war, or not about any of that?
I guess it's a story about every war. It's a story about every defeat or withdrawal. And it's a story about any military outpost, but yeah, and also about us sending 18-year-old to battle to the front lines. And are we asking enough questions when we do so?
Was there criticism of the book and maybe the subsequent film in Israel, because it's such a tender subject to seem to be at all critical of Israel's military and moves to defend herself?
It wasn't any political debate or something. People talked to it as a story, as a novel, as a romance, not too much as the political side of it. But it is, in many aspects, it is an anti-war story, and it is a withdrawal story. It begins in the top of the mountain when they take off the flag and go down at the end of the story. It's dealing with a myth of the Israeli history. It's a myth that in Israeli history, which in the end became an optimistic story in many aspects, because it's a story about a group of four mothers, the Four Mothers Movement, which is an Israeli movement that convinced the army or forced the army to withdraw after 18 long years of battle, to withdraw from Lebanon. And this was unprecedented in the Israeli history, that a group of civilians, more than that, a group of mothers that know nothing about strategic affairs, succeeded in forcing the army to withdraw. Generals usually ruled unquestioned.
At one point, one of the troops says, four women back home are driving us out, meaning the activists back home.
This is some kind of a debate that is relevant for everyone around the globe. And I was, at the beginning, when the book was published in Israel, I really thought of it as a very Israeli intimate story. And suddenly now, when the book is published in 11 countries, not only US and Europe, also places like Korea, I start to understand that this is a very universal story that is relevant for each of us and in many aspects.
Ron Leshem is author of Beaufort. The film based on his novel is up for an Oscar this Sunday for Best Foreign Language Entry. He co-wrote the screenplay. For more on all of this, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Ron, thank you very much and best to you on Sunday.
Thank you very much. Thank you.